solution. Well, at this point, given the fact that the war industry has captured the media, captured the two major political parties, academia. I mean, I've taught at Princeton, and the robotics department pretty much works for the defense industry. They do all the underwater robotics and get a lot of money for it. It really is going to come to mass mobilization. And we're headed for a really rough winter. Food prices and fuel prices is not as bad as Europe. I mean, UK is talking about an 80% rise in energy bills in October. The unrest, you know, is creating, and the deprivation and the billions of dollars that are being siphoned off to Ukraine is, of course, fuel the rise of this neo-fascism throughout Europe, and not just Europe, in the United States as well.
And that wraps it up for another episode of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Senior producers are Miguel Gavilan Molina and Kevin Pina. Technical director is Mike Biggs. For previous episodes, go to kpfa.org or flashpoints.net. For questions or comments, email dennis@kpfa.org. Thank you for listening.
To Community Radio KBOO Portland.
Got troubles, I got them too. There isn't anything I wouldn't do for you. We stick together, can see it through, cause you got a friend in me.
Tune in to KBOO on Wednesday, October 5th. For Dead Moon Night,
a four-hour extravaganza
celebrating the 2017 event when 1,100 rockers showed up outside Portland City Hall
to commemorate the legendary band Dead Moon in an official city proclamation of October 5th as Dead Moon Night.
Again, that's Dead Moon Night, Wednesday, October 5th, from 8 p.m. till midnight.
Here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Tune in every second and fourth Saturday night, midnight to 3 a.m. Sounds unsound. Sounds unsound. Sounds unsound. Only on KBOO.
Sounds unsound. Hey yo, this is Clipping. You're listening to KBOO.
Today's episode, we'll be joined by the McDaniels High School students and one of the curators from PICA. We wanted to give a big thank you to both parties for joining us on today's episode. Another update I wanted to mention was that we will be uploading previous episodes of the show onto our YouTube channel. You can find us simply as Art Talk Bus Stop. Now, enjoy today's episode.
Okay, it's happening. thanks, Roya, for coming to visit with the class. We're all excited that, you know, we're excited to be here and we're excited to have you. So I'm just going to pass the microphone around and let the students one by one introduce themselves. And actually, since you all are in different classes, I think, just say what class that you're in.
My name's Paige. I'm in journalism.
Hi, Paige.
My name's Sam, and I am in mixed media English.
Hi, Sam.
My name is Tyler, and I'm in editorial leadership or journalism.
Great. These classes sound so interesting.
I'm Anthony, and I'm in newspaper.
I'm Eva, and I'm in newspaper and journalism.
I'm Sebastian, and I'm also in newspaper and journalism.
I'm Oliver, and I'm in mixed media English.
I'm Adrian, and I'm in English.
And then hi, I'm Nicole. I'm your regular person who's been here for a long time.
Nice to see you again.
And I guess I'll introduce myself in case you're listening on the radio and you've never heard our show. My name's Erica Thomas, and I co-host Art Talk Bus Stop with Nicole Cabrera, who just introduced herself. And we are recording this episode from McDaniel High School, which is going to be our new partner school for the remainder of the 22-23 school year. So we'll be doing most of our episodes until, I guess, next summer, right here. So welcome, Roya. Maybe let's just let you start off. If you can just say kind of in your own words who you are and what you do, a little bit about your career.
Sure. Thanks for having me. I'm Roya Amir Soleimani. My pronouns are she, her, and I am currently the artistic director and curator of public engagement at PICA, where you were the other day, which stands for Portland Institute for Contemporary Art. And I spent some years before my current position at PICA working as the director of community engagement for the organization. So I've been at PICA since 2012, and I actually interned there before that as a graduate student at the University of Oregon in arts management. So I did my master's in arts management, which is what kind of led me to working in artistic programming and curation with a concentration in contemporary art. My undergrad studies were in essentially like English and literature, gender studies, and contemporary art history. So I started kind of early with an interest in contemporary art, but I didn't know what that meant at the time. Like, how would that translate into a job or career? And I think that we're thinking in very new and interesting and different ways about what a career even looks like now. You know, a lot of people work independently or in very hybrid ways, but I've always incorporated a practice of like working with art, nonprofit art organizations, writing, working directly with artists, and working with communities. And I've had a strong interest from kind of my early time, you know, working in the arts, in connecting a really broad public to contemporary art, because sometimes we have a very narrow community that engages with it that can be really that can really lack diversity. And so I've always been really committed to the idea of broadening and democratizing access to the art world.
So you kind of just answered one of the questions that we were all talking about before we joined the Zoom together, but some of the students I think might be curious about what it means to you to be a curator. It sounds like you were kind of just talking about, you know, interacting with the public and things like that, but just in brief, what does being a curator look like to you?
Sure, it's a great question, and I probably have a different answer for it depending on my mood or, you know, the time of my life or job that you asked me that question, and I think it has changed a lot in the last couple of years since the pandemic. And at this point, I would say that the way I think about curating in some ways goes back to the original definition of curation or curator, which is to care for. But the idea had been, or the definition had been, to curate objects or care for objects, right? Like, think of museums, think of artifacts, think of art object, fine art objects, decorative objects, all the things that might make us question and problematize the idea of museums now. But when I think of working in a contemporary art context with artists who work across lots of different forms, like dance, theater, visual art, design, music, film, multimedia, sound, I'm thinking about caring for artists and their ideas. So how can I support an artist in realizing a new project, a new vision, a new concept, And how do I care for audiences and communities that are going to be engaging with it? So it's not only about the artist and their work, but about providing a context for the public, a broad public, to interact with it. And sometimes that means a lot of like deep work in communities to connect with the populations that the artist really sees their work being for, or that they want to center in their practice. Other times they're interested in as many people as possible and as broad a cross-section of communities as possible. But it's really, for myself and Pika, I think it's all about creating an opportunity for an artist to realize their project in the around the specificity of Portland and what it means to present your work here, whether they're local to Portland already or whether they're coming from out of state or out of the country. And we work with artists across different generations. You know, they might be young, they might be older, and also, of course, different forms and disciplines and different geographies. So there's a real range, and every project requires a different kind of care and support and contextualization. And so I try to customize that with every project that I do.
Great. Well, I think it's a good idea if we turn the mic over to the students, because they all came with questions. So what we're going to do is we're going to pass this mic around just like we did with introductions. Sorry, you can't see me in there.
No, I can too.
And then I'm going to let them just kind of like popcorn style, like nominate to ask questions. So does anybody feel brave enough to go first?
So thinking specifically to Friday night, those 2/3 artists that we saw, how did you specifically pick those artists, and like how did you think that they would, I don't, maybe like help the community or like impact the people that were going to see them?
Sure. So I just want to clarify, are we talking about the first show you saw with the 3 dancers in the small black box theater, or are
both of them?
Both. Okay. So there was that show, which was Takahiro Yamamoto with David Thompson and Anna Martine Whitehead. And then after that, you saw Joseph Keckler in the big room with Holland Andrews, who performed kind of in the middle of that two-person performance. So I can talk about both. With Takahiro, who also goes by Taka, Taka has been based in Portland for a long time. So he's a local artist that we've worked with a couple of times before. And with both local and non-local artists, Pika does try to support projects over the lifespan of an artist's career or practice, because we know that an artist really grows and changes with time, and that they need support beyond just a one-off project. So with Taka, it was an opportunity to work with him again to present his newest work. And something that we did with that piece is co-commission it. And what that means in the performing arts world, and when you commission, is that you invest financially in the project to help it creatively develop. So through rehearsals and residency time for Taka, Martine, and David to have time together to develop it, conceptualize it, practice it, and get it to a place where we then premiered it, that takes other organizations to come in and provide that kind of support too. But Pika was kind of a lead in advocating for that project. And we've been interested in supporting kind of the experimental choreographic practice that Taka has. And we have a real commitment to supporting predominantly artists of color at Pika. So that was also an important consideration in investing in Taka's work and ensuring that Portland artists are getting visibility even on it within an international festival like TBA. With Joseph Keckler and Holland Andrews' performance, That's interesting because it's just been a long conversation with that artist about what they might want to do. And, you know, COVID created a situation in which we really couldn't bring artists from outside of Portland for a couple of years. We had to do most things online, or sometimes they were very small scale live, but here by artists from here and not from elsewhere. Joseph's based in New York, so is Holland. And we were able to support this idea of a new film project that will release in the fall. And this live performance was based on some of the content from that film that will be released later. But it was really considering what it would mean for two artists who have these sort of experimental performance and vocal practices, specifically with their voice, but are very different from one another, to be paired. And they're friends and collaborators already. So And Holland Andrews used to be based in Portland. So they have a following and a community here as well. And so that was, an effort to provide like a different kind of experience for Portland artists that was a real, it was like a variety show where there was writing, there was video art, and there was experimental music and sound and voice. And as far as in talking about both of those projects, one after the other, and thinking about the communities that might have been impacted or who would connect with the work, four of those five artists that I just spoke about are artists of color. And when we met with them to talk about who their work is for, who they would want in the room, this is not always the case, but in this case, you know, they talked a lot about wanting non-white audiences alongside other people. Like that felt important to them, that they wanted their work to really reach beyond the narrowness that sometimes comes with a typical art audience, like mainstream art audience. They also we also wanted to create an experience that felt like kind of live in the moment work that people really have to come together for and be the audience for, or the work is really incomplete, and that built off audience energy and kind of shared space of people in a room, and that wouldn't necessarily just translate to a video screen or online. That kind of work is important too, but we were really with this festival and these two projects included trying to tap into the substance and material of live performance and the energy that comes with that can't really be replicated on a flat screen. Does that answer your question, kind of? Okay. Thank you for it. It's great.
I think something that I thought was really nice about that selection, because we asked for some ideas for which shows the students might want to see, and I think like the first show, Taka's performance is very, it's a really like emotionally intense performance. And so I thought like there's a care also for the audience built in, that if you go to both of those shows, that like you have at first something really intense and then you have comedy afterwards. And so there's like a kind of release after this really like intense experience. So it was kind of, I could feel the kind of like care extending into the audience in that choice.
Yeah, absolutely. Tone is really important. Balance. We knew that we eventually, once Taka's project kind of came to, kind of took shape, we knew it was going to be really dark and heavy and intense and emotional, like you said. We knew Joseph, even when some of his content is a little dark, it's dark humor. Holland is really beautiful and intricate and intimate and heavy in its own way, but not in the way Taka's is, right? So we really do try to think about the full experience for an audience going through the festival or even just one night.
Okay, so when choosing artists and everything, do you reach out to the artists or do the artists reach out to you?
That's a great question. So different organizations curate in different ways, and sometimes they have multiple modes of curation even within one organization. For PICA, most of our curation is what we call by invitation, meaning that the curators and even the people surrounding PICA, like other staff, community members, artists that we've worked with or that are connected to us, they're seeing and experiencing and engaging with art all the time. And for us, you know, we start to become maybe interested in an artist and their work and want to see what they do next and be a platform and a space for that. And we somehow feel excited about how it could live in or exist in Portland and connect with Portland audiences. And it's not just about liking an artist's work. It's about really thinking about that artist and the way that they work and whether that could be a good fit for PICA and Portland and our communities. And so we will usually make an invitation, start a conversation about what that artist might want to do next in their practice. Because we're usually inviting a brand new project. We're not just taking something that happened somewhere else and flopping it into our space or in another space we might be working in. So that we're not touring exhibitions or projects in quite the same way that some other institutions do. And then that becomes usually a long conversation. It could be a year, it could be a couple of years. Sometimes it's quicker, it just depends. But it's all about everything from timing to when the artist feels their project is ready, when they're available, when PICA has space in our calendar to program. There's a lot of factors, but we're typically making that invitation. However, artists are always welcome, and we may need to make this more known, to be honest, but artists are always welcome to approach us. They could email us, they could, you know, find us in a room at an art event that we're all at. They could reach out to us in some way and let us know, hey, here's what I'm working on. We also just hear about artists through other artists or through community members and begin to research their work like that. We do travel to other places and we go to other festivals, we go to other performances, we go to other exhibitions, we see that work and sometimes get really excited about an artist and start the process of inviting them to do something with PICA. So it's by invitation, but also we try to be accessible so that an artist can comfortably approach us with a possibility or an idea, and we're very open to that too.
I just wanted to like squeeze this question in. It was a bit more related to sort of like artists and like approaching institutions. So I guess, you know, as yourself coming from an institution and someone within it, how can artists sort of approach you? Because I know you say, you know, we want to be more approachable, but as someone who's like slowly getting into the field, it's like very awkward and everyone hates it and no one knows how to be like, hey, look at my work. So as someone on the receiving end, how can an artist present their work that is in a way not sort of overbearing or like annoying or like, you know, because I think a lot of us feel very like insecure about possibly showing our work. And I know maybe you guys might come across this in your future careers because, you know, networking, that's how you network. So yeah, how do you recommend to artists to reach out?
Yeah, that's such an important question because I know that it is really intimidating and uncomfortable. It can be anyway, uncomfortable, and that there's a perception that curators might be cold or snobby or standoffish or highly selective. And I mean, the reality is that there are so many more artists and projects than PICA would ever have the time, space, or money to be able to present, right? So we at the end of the day, it's true. We only can work with so many artists and far fewer than we wish we could. But given that, there can still be real benefit to having a conversation with a curator about your work, practicing approaching somebody or an organization or institution, and just starting to get more comfortable with speaking about your work or sharing it or framing your ideas around it, you know, different ways of articulating who you are as an artist. And who you are as an artist changes over time, even day to day in a way. And that doesn't have to be a fixed thing, just like your own sense of self. And it doesn't have to be written perfectly. It can be an imperfect sort of picture that you paint of who you are or where you're at with your artistic work, and to just be comfortable with the fact that maybe it won't look as polished until you have more resources or until you're farther along, or maybe it's in its early stages and you're still trying to work through ideas. But approaching an organization, it could look like an email. I would recommend if you're talking about an organization that's in your own town, actually coming to events, showing up and supporting other artists, looking at their work, experiencing what it feels like to be in an art exhibition opening or a performance, demonstrating interest in that organization and the work that they do and the work that the curators do, and more importantly, what other artists in your community are doing, and really showing up for them, because you will see that reflected back in showing up for you, you know, if you continue to practice art. Writing about your own art can be really great, and that's practicing that and then sharing that writing alongside the work that you might have that is more visual or performance based. All of that can be really wonderful. But I think that being kind of casual and friendly about it and thinking of it as just like a a conversation and not a job interview or something yet is a good place to start. But don't ever hesitate to share, at least for PICA, don't hesitate to share your work. Having some web presence is good too, whether it's an Instagram, a website, somewhere that you can, maybe you have video and you put it on Vimeo or YouTube, but pointing, being able to point someone to where some of your art lives or examples of it is really helpful and helps someone who maybe has to start making decisions about what they're going to present in their, you know, within their organization or program in the next year or two. It's just great to have a reference point. And at PICA, we have three curators. So we work together and we make decisions collectively. A lot of places only have one. Some places have 10. It depends if it's a massive museum or a tiny space. It varies. But sometimes artists are, curators are also artists. And in our case, my colleagues are also practicing artists. I don't consider myself one necessarily. I do write creatively, and that's a little separate. But just to say that sometimes you wouldn't realize how much a curator can actually relate to being an artist too. So,
When you first saw the shows, what did you think about them?
That's a great question too. When I first saw Taka's show with David and Martine, it was a preview performance for a group of people that they invited to see it and provide feedback. But instead of just saying to the audience, "So what did you think?" they asked very specific questions of us about things that they wanted to work through in the show, ideas or problems or things they were trying to figure out, things they couldn't quite tell were working or not. And so the conversation was really focused on having a discussion about what was and wasn't working or feeling good. And I was very startled when the rug came down from the ceiling in the preview. I think it was even more like loud and kind of teetering and scary. And everyone jumped out of their seats. But we all felt, maybe like you all did, I'd be curious to hear, but pretty kind of captivated and kind of watching closely and very observant and quiet, but also moving in and out of different states of emotion. Like, it's okay to get bored in performance too. And so sometimes, I mean, you might have experienced this, I did, but when they're moving backwards at the beginning, you're at a certain point, you might go, when are they going to do something else? You know, this is okay. You can have that reaction. And so I remember feeling that. I remember feeling really moved and almost disturbed at certain times. It has unsettling qualities, but also really comforting ones, like watching the artists care for each other after they've had their intense solo moments that are very cathartic and very, you know, emotionally draining and physically intensive for them to perform individually, and then to have someone else, other people on stage who've watched them coming to take care of them. Those are really beautiful moments. And so I was really moved by it, you know, even when it was also mixed with things like a little bit of restlessness or, you know, just a bewilderment. And with Joseph and Holland, you know, what's neat about TBA is that we don't always see the performances beforehand. So all I saw, because it's brand new, so all I saw was a tech rehearsal. So you saw the first full performance of that show ever, and so did I. And so we saw that together, and I didn't always know. I knew some of what to expect. I knew some of the structure. I knew some of the content. And there were even, like, jokes and some of the writing in there. I had no idea that was in there. I didn't know until close to when it happened which clips were going to be incorporated. And Joseph works in that way, where he'll work really, you know, deliberately and diligently for a long time, but not really make final decisions and edit down until close to the time of the performance. And Holland, I knew was going to be performing in the middle, but I didn't know quite where they would take it other than being concentrated on their voice. And I did not expect, even though I've seen them perform before, I didn't expect to be so transported to, like, another place. I thought it was really beautiful and deep and took me somewhere else. So I enjoyed both of them, but they were really different and I didn't know what to expect necessarily either. So
was there a possibility that Joseph and Holland were kind of grouped together because in a sense, their vocals were both very like melodic, and they had a larger range, and it was more like opera-ish. Or
yeah, that's a good question. So actually, we didn't curate Joseph and Holland together. They made that work together. So they, yeah, so they proposed that collaboration. And the film that Joseph has directed that includes Holland's performance in it also has a conversation between them. And we'll make sure that you all get to see that film when we release it in the fall. It has a conversation between them about their artistic practices and the nature of being artists now in this world and in these times, which I think is really interesting. But I think that they have gravitated towards one another as friends and artistic practitioners, in a sense, who use the voice as an instrument. And yes, they both have classically trained vocal practices, but then they experiment with them and they go in all of these other non-traditional directions with it, right? So it's unexpected and unconventional. And in Holland's case in particular, uses a lot of synth and pedals and looping and reverb and all of these kind of electronics. And Joseph, in, you know, I think a lot of the collision of forms comes with these really humorous stories that he tells through operatic German vocal performance, you know, which is not something we predict is going to happen when we hear someone singing like that and then we read the lyrics. So as you saw in the performance, he also writes and presents more of a monologue in spoken form, but he really likes to create a variety of experiences within 1 hour's time.
Great question. Roya, we're like kind of halfway in, and I want to turn the tables a little bit and just see if you have any questions that you want to ask the students.
I'd love to. Thank you. I have a few, but I'll try to just, you know, pick a couple and see where it goes. I was curious, first off, have any of you ever been to PICA before?
No.
Okay. Had you ever heard of it or the time-based art festival?
No.
Yeah, I wouldn't say I've heard of it, but I've seen it like happen sometimes because I like bike past there. I'm like, oh wow, there's like a lot of like people grouped here.
I think I've heard of the time-based art festival, but I've never seen or really looked that far into it.
Yeah. Do you think that you would have like discovered it one day on your own, or did it really make a difference to have an organized experience, like to have your class go see something together and talk about it? Did that help feel, give you the sense that like, I don't know, you could show up and engage with it in a way that maybe would have been harder by yourself?
Yeah, I think it would have taken me a lot longer to find PICA and the Time-Based Art Festival if it hadn't been for this opportunity, so I really appreciated being able to do this, but I think eventually I would have found it.
Yeah. What did it feel like being at that venue? Because, you know, sometimes we have more experiences in a place like a traditional museum or maybe a theater with a proscenium stage and curtains and raked seats, you know, like these are the kinds of spaces we're told art exists in, or maybe a gallery, you know, an art gallery. So what did it feel like for you to be in a warehouse or more of a, like a big, there, you know, there was a big epic space, like the main warehouse, the black box is a bit smaller, but these are what people tend to call all kind of alternative spaces for contemporary art. And I'm just curious how it felt for you to be in there.
It felt, a bit more down to earth rather than kind of like in museums and everything's like posted up on the wall with a ton of lights pointed at it. This is more, I know it's not just like thrown together, but it's more placed just about anywhere and done right then and there.
Yeah, I think like also how earlier we were talking about how it's very like sort of audience driven, you know, like Taka's first performance, that's very like based audience and performance. You know, we feed off of each other, and I learned about this in my college class, but it's like, it's very much audience and artist. It's not like, you know, regular art pieces in a museum, and I think that's what a lot of us felt, you know, is like very interactive and immersive compared to what we're used to. And also with the second performance or second section of the night, it's multimedia. So it's meant to be immersive and different and include different types of media that make it feel much more immersive.
Great. And can I ask how it felt to observe other audience members? Like, did you feel different or out of place? Or like, did you see yourself in other people? Did you feel like you were a lot younger than the rest of the audience? Did you know, was there anything? Yeah, what did you notice about who was there to see this work?
That was a resounding nod, yes, that they felt younger than the rest.
I'm pretty sure the youngest person that I'm just gonna guess their age, other than who, like our group that went, was probably like 24, and then everybody else was higher 20s, 30s, 40s. Pretty sure I saw somebody that looked like they were in their like 50s as well.
Probably some 60s too. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like a wide age range, but up until like 25, then it takes off.
And why do you think that is? Do you think that art like that is, do we worry that it's going to be inappropriate or boring or uncomfortable for younger people? Do you think that it should be more accessible to people your age? Or yeah, just what are your thoughts about that? I'm curious.
I think it was more of like, well, I do know that you guys do like trial, and you know that, yeah, there's a possibility this might be exposed to a younger audience, that we might want to try and make it like PG or something. But at the same time, it's art, and that's not exactly like your job to do that. It's more of like for you to show the artist's work from my perspective. But I definitely do feel like I did feel like the youngest person like in the room, especially with watching like some of the really crazy stuff. It was kind of just like, yeah, I think I'm young here. But go
either. Yeah, mine just went blank, but let me see if I can think of something. It did feel a little bit strange, especially being like on a school field trip being there. I feel like if it was me and my friends, it wouldn't have been weird at all. But just being on a school field trip, it was a little bit strange for me, but I still had fun and I still enjoyed all the art.
I'm glad to hear that. I think that we could do more. Oh, there's more. Okay, I want to hear more. Yes.
Okay. I feel like art is a way that a lot of people express themselves. And I feel like even if some stuff is like more mature, I feel like the more like teenagers or like more younger audience should be exposed to it, because like maybe they can find like a way to express themselves into it and like have opportunities to like put themselves into that kind of field. I think it'd be like better for us if we got exposed to it more.
I love hearing that.
I agree with that, where art is really just the artist's take on something, and you can't really put a lot of filters on that unless you don't want, because it's like their true take on something. And if you put filters on it, it's just not really their take as much anymore. And I would like to add on to what Eva said, where it was very interesting being there for school field trip, because like listening to Joseph's dark humor and everything, I turn and my teacher is sitting next to me. Especially in some of his like more mature songs. I just sit there and I look up at her and I'm like, aren't you so glad you just took us here just for this?
No idea what the original question is now, but I just like to say that wait, what was the original question, Han?
Oh, just like, kind of like what it felt like to be the age you are in that audience.
Oh, but yeah, but I was gonna just say that I think I know why there's not many people that are young that are there. And it's probably because everyone's like not on that media.
I had a moment during the first show where I had like looked over like to other audience members, and everyone seemed like so engaged and serious with watching people slowly step back, and I got really confused because I was like, do these older people know something that I don't? Am I not getting like a metaphor? And I stood there, and at one point I even whispered to Tyler like, hey, what's going on? In case they got it and I didn't. So yeah, young.
Yeah, and I had no idea what was happening either.
I wanted to say something for the other, like, just being young or maybe, like, not enough kids, like, being here. I think it's just because I know I personally have never heard of PICA before this, so it's not a lot of advertising about it, and I feel like, yeah, just being young around, I was feeling like Sebastian, and is like, yeah, I don't really understand what's happening here, but other people are understanding it, so I might like try to understand it, because obviously there's something going on, there's something important going on at that.
Yeah, we had an interesting conversation, Roya. We, in between the shows, we went and got some dinner at the food carts, and we just kind of had like a really casual conversation about like what everybody thought was happening in that show, Taka's show, which we saw first. And I think that maybe you all had an expectation that I would like know. And I was like, I don't know either. It's like all of our interpretations, it's like whatever we read into it is like allowed. And then we ended up having this like really incredible conversation about things. Like I asked you guys, what did it make you think about? And you were like, oh, it made me think about, you know, like grief or like these other like big feelings. Or like it made me think about care and like some of the words you're using, Roya, to describe your practice as a curator. So it's kind of interesting that it's like you all intuited what was going on. I mean, as much as I did or anyone else that was in the room, like you did know what was going on as much as everyone else.
I really love hearing that, because I think that that's part of what can make contemporary art and performance intimidating and feel inaccessible, is this idea that there's something to get that everyone else gets that you don't, right? And certainly that feeling can surface when you're having the experience in the moment. But I really would encourage you, and I wish someone had told me this a lot longer ago, that to enter into art experiences, that even ones like this that might be more experimental or abstract, with the idea that any knowledge or interpretation or perspective that you bring is just as valid as the next person. So you don't have to have a formal background or education in dance or art history or the themes or ideas that might be undergirding that performance or that particular project. Those things can help to maybe broaden how you might view or understand a performance, or it might actually narrow it. You know, it doesn't always serve you to have these really strict notions of what something might mean, what certain gestures or movements or symbols or whatever might be happening on stage. Sometimes you get so used to seeing this kind of work over and over again that it actually impedes your ability to kind of think outside of what you're constantly seeing. So it's really nice to have a fresh perspective. But most of the artists we work with, there are some exceptions, everyone's different, but most of the artists we work with at PICA, when we talk about what their work means, they are just excited to hear how other people think about it and how they felt when they were in the room, or what they thought was funny or boring or confusing or beautiful or you know, whatever it might be. And sometimes there's really specific ideas and content, research, themes that the artist might be drawing on, but they don't always want that to be what drives your understanding of the work. They want you to bring yourself to it, so that in the end, there are endless possibilities for how we might individually and collectively experience and understand a piece of art, whether that's a dance
or, and even if it doesn't look like dance, it might be a dance, or theater, or music, or visual art, what have you. So I think I love this conversation, and I think the most important thing that can happen after an art experience is for people to talk about it and share what they felt.
I think we were still on questions for the students.
Yeah. Did anybody else have anything they wanted to add? Or Roya, do you have other questions for the students?
Yeah, I can ask more questions. So I was wondering we kind of talked a little bit about this, but the contrast between like the really heavy emotional content that you might have, experienced with Taka and David and Martine's show, and then with Joseph and Holland, that has a couple of different, moods going on. Holland's is a bit different from Joseph's, but we talked about them kind of complementing each other, but do you feel in seeing work side, different kinds of work side by side, which is what a festival tries to do, like give you lots of different kinds of experiences in one concentrated period of time, do you think that opens you up to maybe being interested in seeing work that you might not necessarily immediately like or connect with, but leaves you asking a lot of questions? Or did you find it more, I don't know, more comfortable, more entertaining even to get what was going on and have it be more legible and even like a little bit lighter or a little bit funnier? I'm just thinking about all the different moods and if it opens you up to thinking about how you want to experience art.
I think I was definitely more comfortable watching something that I kind of knew what was going on, but I think with a lot of art, it's important to push your comfort zone. And so I liked getting the experience to kind of see something and experience something that I hadn't before, even if I was uncomfortable most of the time. I think it was important to push myself to do that. So I think kind of both.
I was about the same. Normally I would never watch anything or go to the experience of Tonka's show, but watching it was confusing, like in the moment, but afterwards it was so confusing, but you kind of got a bit more of what was happening because it you let it process. And it also made me really wonder what his previous shows were, because we were told going in that he makes art out of uncomfort. So as soon as he becomes comfortable doing something, he comes up with a different performance. So I was wondering what the last performances he did were.
Yeah, I was actually the one who told them that Taka's work is very, like, always changing just because of his previous performance. Was it at the Portland Museum?
Yeah, that was at the Portland Museum.
Yeah. We had someone from the show, Ayana. She went, and she wasn't on the show, but when we interviewed him, he talked about that, and I had told him about that. And I also told Erica, like, the performance art is so much more different when you view it, like, on a video, because it's just video. You don't get the feeling of what it's like in person. And the first thing I said was, like, it's interesting to feel the performance versus just watching it. And I think that kind of opened my eyes a bit about, like, what performance art is, or like, you know, like the sort of not purpose, but like just it as a form of art. Like, it makes a bit more sense when you're watching it live versus, you know, in a video.
Yeah, we actually had Taka on the show. He was the most recent guest that we did live. Mm-hmm. And he talked about that performance, but I wonder if, like, it is so different to see something in person. And I think I actually didn't really engage with much like experimental work like that in the pandemic, because I just didn't feel drawn to the idea of seeing stuff like that on Zoom. And I wonder if you want to say anything about how this year's festival might have felt different for you to work on, Roya, than during the pandemic, these last 2 years where you were trying to make things happen in a virtual way. You have a question? Okay, go for it.
I don't know if you brought it up, but I heard things about pandemic. I may have already forgotten, but like, what was PICA like during the pandemic?
Yeah, I think the questions are both very related. During the pandemic, PICA really couldn't do what you just saw the other day. So we couldn't have artists travel safely. We couldn't have artists be in the same space safely. It was very expensive to do anything when we were up against the challenges of, you know, the economic precarity of those times when the pandemic was just starting. Everyone had to work from home. And it became really difficult to think about how we present live art and artists who make live performance. But it was also an opportunity. It was an opportunity to really like look inwardly and examine institutions and the ways, including PICA, and the ways in which we haven't always lived by the values and politics that we aspire to, and that we all fall into the shortcomings of nonprofit institutions and the art world and the ways that those things can be really exclusive and problematic. So it was a time to really be introspective in a way about the organization and our community and how we can, once we were back to presenting, and we didn't know when that would be, right? But once we got back to presenting live art like this, how could we do it better? How could we do it in closer alignment with our values? And it forced a lot of important changes at PICA. But in terms of working directly with artists, I think that we had to present online. We also learned that sometimes online, especially in a pandemic, which is still going on, online and virtual content is the only way that some people can engage with live art because they might be immunocompromised or have other disabilities or conditions that don't allow them to go to a theater or a performance space. And a lot of venues aren't accessible in a lot of different ways. So it actually is important for organizations like PICA to try to get to a place where we're presenting work live and online and have versions, some mix of content that takes both of those or all of those forms. But it takes more money, it takes more resources, it takes technical skills, equipment, all kinds of things that we sort of have to figure out how to get there. And it's not easy, but that's how it looked for a couple of years, mostly online or very small scale projects last year that happened with just local artists, just at PICA, a handful of projects and no real socializing or, you know, group activity. People were in and out and it was really limited. And it felt, I mean, the work that we presented and the artists we worked with, it was all really important and felt significant in its own way, but also it felt really compromised.
Roya, thank you for that answer. The students have their next class to go to. I know. Their next class, aka going home and socializing.
Yeah, you should get home. I don't want to keep you past your school day.
I just wanted to say thanks to all of you for coming with me trusting me to take you on this weird field trip. And thanks, Roya, for on behalf of PICA, for inviting all of us to do this and making it happen. Everyone had an amazing time, it sounds like, and I'm really appreciative. This is a super great way to kick off our year of podcasting. So,
thank you so much. I love that you were there for it and really appreciate this conversation. And I want younger people to be in the audience at PICA. And so this is helping me think about how we can do that differently and do it better. Thank you so much for being part of it. And if there's anything else at TBA you want to see the rest of the next week and weekend, let Erica know, she can let me know, and we can get you tickets.
Thank you, Roya. That's very generous. Yeah. Appreciate it a lot.
Thank you so much. All right.
Roya, I'll just give you a chance to like promo anything.
Yes, thank you. So for everything TBA Festival related, and this is our 20th year of this annual festival, you can find that on pica.org/TBA. And all of our events are sliding scale tickets. Some of them are free, some of them are $5, some start at $10. And you can find ticket links on the website, as well as descriptions and videos and trailers and photos and all kinds of more information and a schedule of events. And then we have a couple of things that go beyond September. So there's Into October, there's an exhibition by Jamil Olalowe Kosoko at PNCA at the Center for Contemporary Art and Culture there. And there's also an exhibition at Reed College's Cooley Gallery with the artist Sasha Wartzel. So both of those things go into October and November, respectively. So people have more time to check those out. And the festival goes till September 18th. And PICA has activity year-round, not just the festival. So you can find lots more about what we have done and what we will be doing coming up on PICA.org.
As we end today's episode, another reminder is that you can find our previous episodes now on our YouTube channel as Art Talk Bus Stop. You've been listening to Art Talk Bus Stop on KBOO FM, Portland 90.7 FM. You can hear our show the fourth Wednesday of every month. Tune in October 26th for our next episode.
This is Dr. Caldicott talking on 90.7 FM KBOO. You all realize how terribly important this radio station is now that the federal government is trying to cut funds for National Public Radio. And you all realize that the real truth only comes out of public radio and that all the rest of the media is compromised and represents the corporations who are destroying the earth. So you absolutely have to support KBOO with lots of money now. It's imperative, and you all know that.
Welcome to World Ocean Radio. I'm Peter Neal, director of the World Ocean Observatory. Some 20 years ago, as I contemplated the founding of the World Ocean Observatory, I asked a scientist I met over lunch at my first ocean conference, what is the most pressing challenge to ocean health and sustainability? His response was immediate, without hesitation. Acidification, he said. And I had no idea what he was talking about. I recently came across an article by science writer Mary Hoff, in which she surveys the conclusions of 30 conservation experts from around the world, published in the July 2022 journal Nature, Ecology, and Evolution, that added 15 new ocean challenges, comparably surprising, equally disturbing. Let me paraphrase them here. Fire fallout, the increasing frequency and severity of wildfire on land through wind and rain distributes soot, chemicals, and other burn byproducts into the ocean. Dark matter, increased sediment and nutrient imbalance resulting from climate change, coastal development, thawing permafrost, promoting algae growth and other plant productivity, and moderating sunlight and its relation to life systems and species survival. Toxic metals, industrial waste and pollutants deposited from onshore, affecting water chemistry, contaminating fish and shellfish consumed by humans and introduced into our bodies by ingestion and absorption. Pole shift, increased change to water temperature and organism migration from the warmer waters of the equator toward the cooler waters of the pole. Fatty acid famine, limited production of essential fatty acid by fish, limited by changing ocean environmental conditions and feeding patterns. Protein potential, the harvest of collagens for consumer goods, such as cosmetics from livestock to ocean animals, such as sponges, jellyfish, and sharks. Swim bladder demand, growth in the cultural demand for dried fish swim bladders as a food luxury, contributing to waste and the endangerment of certain species on which other species depend. Carbon removal, the decrease in fish population resulting in decreased carbon sequestration by these animals as counteraction to climate change. Lithium water, the extraction of lithium for battery demand for electric vehicles and energy storage through deep sea mining with destruction of ocean floor and biodiversity. Volume, the increased exploitation of ocean resources as land resources are exhausted or polluted, demanding co-location, cluster enterprise, regulation, technology, and other efforts to maintain sustainability. Cities at sea, the prospect of floating cities and other initiatives for citizen relocation, aquaculture, and hydroponic production, protection against invasive species, and other innovations that add further threat to ocean systems. Green pollutants, the growth in green technologies that require greater use of chemicals and rare metals, with after effects to include fertilizers, trace metals, waste treatment, leaching, and other advertent and inadvertent deposits into watersheds, coastal areas, and ocean systems with negative implication for sea life. New technological impacts, the unforeseen consequence of research, robots, radio signals, sonar, underwater radar, underwater cables, and other initiatives associated with mapping, planning, location, and other technological innovations for expanded study and exploitation of the ocean. Biodegradation, the exponential growth of the degradation of plastics and other land wastes that are already a critical condition with ever-increasing toxicity comparable to acidification and compounding that already pervasive toxic condition. For every action, there is a reaction. There is no reason that our deplorable record of behavior on land will not extend to the sea unless we understand now in advance that the old systems of values and choices will not enable an ocean on which we must now depend for survival. Danger lurks in even the most progressive policy or technology unless there is a new paradigm for evaluation and application, one that this time around truly protects and sustains the potential of a nurturing ocean, of an asset that, if lost, will be a catastrophe of political and social will, an undoing for which there will be no repair. We will discuss these issues and more in future editions of World Ocean Radio.